Today's shiur begins halfway down the omid, maybe a little bit more, if you like counting lines, 26 lines from the top. You can also notice where we begin if you notice Tosfos Dibur HaMashal Prat LeZorek, opposite that in the Gemara, the second word on the line, Gufa. And you will notice the underlined name, Omar Rebbe Zera. Before we begin the actual Gemara, we glance at the side where we have a Nosei Mivneh, a topic heading and structural note combined into one. As you skim down the Gemara, you'll notice a crown shape that appears. This indicates Mekoros, sources, Mi Tanoim Umin Hakra, sources from Tanoim and from verses, L'divrei Rebbe Zera, to support Rebbe Zera's teaching, D'chol Kavua Kemechza Mechza Domi, Gam Lukula. This principle we illustrated, we used in our previous shiur, that even though statistically things might be, we'll say, lopsided, nine verses one, or eight verses two, but if the issue at doubt arises in a situation where the items in question are in their formal location, that's called kavua, they're in their set established location, the doubt takes on the status of 50-50, 50% kosher, 50% not kosher, or 50% one way, 50% the other way, however we happen to be ruling. So if it comes to matters of kashrus, even though you have a lopsided situation, let us say you have, now, based on our previous sukkah, if you had nine stores that were selling kosher meat and one store selling unkosher meat, and you went into one of the stores and bought meat, so that even though nine stores were selling kosher meat and only one store was selling unkosher meat, if you went into one of the stores and bought the meat, you don't know which one you bought it from, you cannot eat the meat, even though nine out of ten were selling kosher meat. But since you went into their mokum of kavius, you cannot use it. The point that we made just now in our introductory, under the Nosei heading, is that this works even if the result is a point of allowance or leniency. So now the Gemara. Gufa, Omar Rebbe Zera, Kol Kavua Kemechzo Al Mechzo Domi. When things are in their established location and there's an issue of there's an issue at doubt, it takes on the status of 50-50. Bein l'kula, bein l'chumra. You'll notice that we squiggle underline l'kula because this is what we want to focus on. Whether the result of saying that is a point of leniency or a point of stringency. Minole le Rebbe Zera ha. Where does Rebbe Zera know that from? The marking that you see now, a volcano shape or trapezoid, is explained on the side as a ma'akav. It's an attempt to keep track of the give and take structure. With the narrow part facing up, that's a hatsa'ah limokor. It's a suggestion for a source or as a source. With the inverted volcano shape, that is a dechiyah, a rejection. Again, the emphasis is we're looking for a source of leniency in this principle, or of the application of this principle of kol kavua kemechza mechza domi, when the result is a leniency. So we, Gemara will make a few attempts. The first couple of attempts, you'll see that the Gemara rejects the sources on the grounds that you're illustrating a stringency to me and not a leniency. We're looking for a leniency. So now the Gemara. In lema mitesha chanuyos kulon moichros baser shchuta. The Achas Basar Nevela, the case of the nine stores that sell kosher meat. One store sells Nevela unkosher meat. The Lokach me Achas Man, and you bought from one of the stores Samiv the Eino Yodea me Eza Man Lokach, and you don't know into which store you went to purchase Sveko Osir. The meat that you have is forbidden. Even though 90% chance that it's kosher, it's still forbidden. The next few words are in brackets simply because the main point is stated here, which we dashed underlined, that the balance of this source is a separate issue. Uvenimtso halocha harov, if it's found outside the shops in the street, then you can base yourself on the majority. Anyway, does this source show that we go when something's kavua, it's kemechsa mechsa lekula? No, we don't see that. Lekula means a leniency. Hasam lechumra. In this case, with the 9 stores selling kosher meat, we ended up forbidding, even though 90% chance is that it would have been kosher, and we're forbidding. So that's a stringency. Ella, let's try the next source. Mitishot svardim v'sheretz echad b'neihem. There are different creatures that the Torah features, some of which, when they're dead, they communicate tumah. Others, when they're dead, they don't communicate tumah. So a tzfardea is an example of a creature that does not communicate tumah. A sheretz is an example of a creature that does communicate tumah. So you have 9 non-metamim, the tzfardim, and 1 sheretz is amongst them. V'noga be'echad me'am v'einu yodea be'ezim e'noga. And you touched one of them, and you don't know which one you touched. Sfeiko tome. You have to consider yourself tome. So you see that even though 9 out of 10 of those dead creatures were non-metamim, non-defilers, you're nevertheless considered defiled. So that doesn't show us a hasam nami l'chumra. That too is not going to be the source for what we are looking. That illustrates a stringency. Ela, from the following, mitishot shrotzim utzvadei achas b'nehem. You have 9 defiling type creatures, a pile of dead creatures that are shrotzim, utzvardeya echod b'nehem, and there's 1 dead tzvardeya amongst them. V'noga b'echod b'nehem v'enu yodea b'eza mehen noga, and you touched one of them and you don't know which one you touched. If this took place b'rishus hayochid in a private domain, sfeiko tomei. So based on the halacha l'moshe m'Sinai that sofek tumah b'rishus hayochid is tomei, this is tomei. B'rishus harabim, if this pile of creatures was found in a public thoroughfare, sfeiko tohar. There's a doubt, but you're considered tohar. Even though 90% chance is that you should be tomei, you're nevertheless considered tohar. There's a Rashi that we'll look at together, a few lines down from here. Ela, and toward the lower part of the narrow lines, Ela mitisha shrotzim. Afhi Toysef Maseches Taras. It's a Tanaic source from the Tractate of Taras. V'katoni b'shusachot sveiko tomei b'shusarabim sveiko tor. In a public domain, you would be tor. Almo kemechza domi ulekula. Here you see that we are looking at it as 50% chance. 50-50 tomei, 50 tor. And that's called a sofek. And in a public domain, we are going lekula, lenient. If you wouldn't classify it as sofek tumah, which we accomplish by saying it's 50-50. Again, we're dealing with something that's scriptural. It's all part of an oral tradition. It's not statistics. It's not a case of statistics. It runs counter to statistics, but we're dealing with an oral tradition that governs these matters. If we weren't going to call it 50-50, then it would be Vaday Tumah, the Haruba Shrotzim. The majority are Shrotzim, and in general we follow the majority. But because it's a doubt in a Kavua where they were piled up, that's their location, it takes on this 50-50 status, and that in Hebrew is a Sufek, that's a simple, pure doubt. And in a public domain, when there's a matter of doubt concerning defilement, we rule tohar. The Gemara continues, Midoraisa minolon. Where is there a pasuk that forms the basis of this halacha? Omar Kra, there's a pasuk, and it's quoted, and also take note of the fact that it takes a number of lines to develop this. We call this a long answer marking. The pasuk says, And this pasuk deals with someone who is, let's say, scheming to murder someone. The orav lo v'kom alav. That's a pasuk, someone laying in wait and then killing them. In Maseches Sanhedrin, we must point out that there is a machlokes tanoim concerning a person who planned to kill A and end up killing B. That's called miskave laro gezev hara gezev. Rabbi Shimon says that a person, even though he had murderous intent, since he didn't achieve his goal, he is exempt from capital punishment. And that's what this says. Ad she is kaving lo. He is not guilty of a capital offense until he murdered the one he intended to. Rabbonon Amri Deber Rav Yanai. The Rabbonon disagree in Maseches Sanhedrin, and they hold that if you planned to kill A and ended up killing B, that is a capital offense, and it's punishable by death. So the Rabbonon, in looking at this pasuk that says v'orav lo v'komalov, prat l'zorek even l'go. This is with the exception. In other words, this pasuk comes to exclude a person who throws a stone into a crowd and ends up killing a Jew. And what the Rabbonon are saying, that the Orav Lo V'Komolov tells us, without focusing on the translation, but that Orav Lo V'Komolov is guilty. And we said, the Rabbonon hold, if you plan to kill A and ended up killing B, you would be guilty. What case is not guilty? This case, someone who throws a stone into a crowd and kills someone. Heichi Domi, now what are the circumstances? And you'll notice we have a double underline, one of our series markings, and on the side, under the Nosei Mivneh heading, we've indicated Shlavei Biwur. These are stages in clarifying. Be'ezen Sibois Bo'inon HaPosuk V'Orav Lo K'dei Liftor Mishazark Even L'toch Kvutzah Shel Anoshim V'Horag Yisrael. Under what circumstances do I need the Posuk to exempt someone who threw a stone into a crowd and killed a Jew? Heshi Domi, we go back to the Gemara. If it's a case we have nine Canaanites, nine idol worshippers, and one Jew amongst them, and you threw a stone into the crowd and killed a Jew, the tepuk lay, why not simply derive his innocence or his exemption from a death penalty? The rubal k'nainim ninu, the majority are Canaanite idol worshippers, that if you ended up killing them, you wouldn't be guilty of a capital offense. What do I need the pasuk for if that were the case? The majority of people that are there anyway would be a source of exemption. Inami palga upalga, even if it was a crowd of 50% Canaanite idol worshippers and 50% Jews, still we would not, and he killed a Jew, we would not execute the offender. Safek nefashas lahakel, when there's an element of doubt concerning capital offenses, we rule leniently. I don't need the pasuk for that. Lo tzricha, I need the pasuk for the following. Dikotishi Yisraelim v'knayni echad b'nam. There's a crowd of people, and that's for our purposes. That's their mokum kovua. That's where they have gathered together to have lunch in that particular place. Nine Jews, one Canaanite idol worshipper, and he throws a rock into the crowd, kills a Jew, we will tell you he is exempt. Dahavele Knaini Kavua. The Knaini, that one Knaini, is in his established location. He's not wandering around. That's where he's supposed to be. V'chol Kavua Kemechza Al Mechza Domi. And when you have people in their established location, even though statistically they might be an extreme minority, they take on the identity as being 50% of the crowd, halachically speaking. And now once I knock it up to a 50-50 situation, it becomes a suffix. And as we said before, suffix nefashos lochta. But in order to bump up one guy out of 10 and make him like 5, you need the pusik for that. That's what the Rabbanan learned from the Orav Lo V'Komolov. We continue in the Gemara. It's a new marking, and on the side there's a Nosei Mivneh heading. The triangle that we see represents a Ma'akav, an attempt to keep track of a give and take in the Gemara. We will see here Piske Halacha B'Shmo Sharav. In this Gemara we're going to see some halachic rulings given over in the name of Rav. Ibo inon tre rubi liyuchsin oisagi barov echad. For purposes of pedigree and of purity of lineage, which we call yuchsin, and that has to do with the whole topic before of a woman who was raped by someone and we don't know who it was. Does that affect her purity vis-a-vis her ability now to marry a Kohen? Kohanim having additional requirements. And we saw in our previous shiur that even though one rove ordinarily is enough to establish how to go, in our sugya, on this daf, right before the point in which we began today's shiur, we saw that male osu biyuchasin, a stringency was applied to matters of yuchasin, pedigree, and we insisted on having two roves. So that's going to be the discussion of, do we need two roves for yuchasin or not? And the focus is on Shitas Rav. What does Rav hold? There's an inverted triangle. Kushyas Rav Yirmiya al Hodi Omar Rav Chiya Bar Ashi Mishmei de Rav. Rav Yirmiya will challenge that which Rav Chiya Bar Ashi says in the name of Rav. In this sugya, it's important to be sensitive to the names as we go along. So the Gemara. Itmar Rav Chiya Bar Ashi Omar Rav Halocha Kerebi Yosi. The thinking right now is that ruling like Rav Yosi means that for yuchasin purposes, one rove is enough. And that in the story that we saw in our previous shiur, there was a Mishnah at the bottom of Yud Dalet Amud Beis, the facing Amud. The Mishnah featured Rav Yosi telling us a story about a girl who went to fill up water at a well. And she was raped. And in the Mishnah we saw that Rabbi Yochanan says if the majority of the people are of kosher lineage and pedigree, so she remains muteres, looking allowed to the kahuna. It seems from that Mishnah, By Rav saying that the halacha is like Rav Yosi, seems that if you have the majority of the people in town of kosher lineage, so she's kosher, one rove is enough. Again, I emphasize that's what it sounds like. At the bottom line of the Gemara, you see Mosiv Rav Yirmiya. He will challenge that. He says there. He says Uliuchsin lo boin and trei rubi, and for yichus purposes, you don't need two roves. And the Gemara will continue later with his question. Let's continue. Second line from the bottom. Rav Chonon bar Rova Omar Rav is another presentation of Rav. Hoiroas Shoa Hoisa. The Mishnah that featured Rav Yochanan ben Nuri that said she's kosher if the majority of the people are of the town are of kosher lineage, she's kosher. That was a one-time ruling. Hiruah Shah means a temporary one-time ruling. But for future generations, you actually need to have two roves, two majorities, which we elaborated on in our previous shiur. Certainly, if you haven't listened to it, listen to it now. Mosiv Rebbe Yirmiyah. Uli Yuchasin lo bo'in on Trey Rubi. So Rebbe Yirmiyah asks on Rebbe Chiya Barashi, and he says, what, for Yichus purposes, you don't need to have two roves? V'hotanan, motza bo tinok mushloch. A person finds a child, an abandoned child. Mushloch means he's cast away. An abandoned child. Im rov ovei kechovim, ovei kechovim. If the majority of the people are idol worshippers, so the child has the status of an idol worshipper. Im rov Yisrael, Yisrael. If the majority of the people in that area are Jews, the child has the status of a Jew. Mechza, mechza, Yisrael. If they're 50% Jews, 50% idol worshippers, the child will have the status of a Jew. The details of this source will be the subject of the Gemara later. The Omar Rav Lo Shonu Elolach Yoso. What it says in this source is that if the majority of the people there are Jews, he's considered a Jew. That's only as far as the obligation of the Jewish community to support that child. Avol Liyuchasin Lo. But to consider the child Miyuchas and be allowed to marry into the rank and file Jewish community, that no. Rashi says, if she's a girl, if it's a castaway, abandoned female infant, asur lekoyin, she cannot marry a kohen. V'afilu lekol amechash mishum asufi kon hanachlam yimsar yuchsin mishalti hidmi toli pisko toli kmiya miuchayshin on shem abas oivin kichovim hi. We're choshesh that she might be a daughter of an idol worshipper. According to the opinion that says a convert to Judaism is unfit for the kahuna, she will be forbidden to the kahuna. In other words, if we take in this child and we convert the child, she will still not be allowed to marry a kohen. What do we see from here? The fact that you have one rove, that's not enough. You need to have two roves. And who's the speaker? Rav is the speaker. There's a bracketed section which we put in brackets simply to de-emphasize what is said here. It will be discussed later. Ushmuel Omar Lefakech Olav Esagal. Shmuel says that we say if it's Rove Yisrael is considered Yisrael, that's in order to remove an avalanche of stones from upon him, which involves Chilul Shabbos. We will focus on that, Amir Tzashem, later. For right now, the question at hand is, how can Rav Chiya Bar Ashi, at the beginning of this section, three lines from the bottom of the of Omid Aleph, say that one Rove is enough for Yuchasin? Here, Rav says, one rove is not enough. You have to have two types, two majorities. Majority of the people of the town are of pure lineage, and the majority of caravans coming from outside into the town also are of pure lineage. So this is Rav Yirmiyah's question. The Gemara responds, Ishtamitze, it escaped Rav Yirmiyah's memory. He forgot. Ha the Omer of Yehuda Amar Rav, and again Rav is cited. Rav Yehuda quotes Rav. Bekroinos shel tzipori have maisa. The story in the Mishnah, in which Rav Yossi had presented the case, it was a case, in fact, that there were two roves. And that which Rav Chiya Bar Ashi said in the name of Rav, that the halacha follows Rav Yossi, that is subsuming this point that there it took place. The story had taken place when caravans were passing through the town, rove of whom, the majority of whom, were Jewish, and you can see that Rav requires two roves for yichusin purposes. There was no reason for jumping on Rav Chiya Bar Ashi in the first place. The Gemara now focuses on Rav Chonon Bar Rova. So now we can take advantage of Little Arrow, and that tells you to look back on Omid Aleph, two lines from the bottom. You see Rav Chonan Bar Rava said that the story of the Mishnah was a Hiruas Shah, which we explained that one rove was enough, but that was a one-time ruling. But for future generations, you need to have two roves. So now the Gemara. Ula Rav Chonan Bar Rava Diomar Hiruas Shah Haisa Kashya Ha. According to Rav Chonan, that said that the Mishnah story, which in effect had two roves, based on what we have inserted to the Mishnah, Kronos Shel Tzipori, so the Mishnah in effect represents two roves. And Rav Chonan Bar Rava said about the Mishnah that the Mishnah was a one-time ruling, was a Hiruas Shah. But for future generations, in fact, one rove would be enough. And here, we are saying, in the name of Rav, that for future generations, you really need two roves. So we have a problem now for Rav Chonan Bar Rava, because according to Rav Chonan Bar Rava, it appears that the two rove necessity was a Hiruas Shah, was a, just for the moment, a ruling of stringency for that moment. But in general, one rove is enough. But here we're demonstrating that Rav requires two roves in general. And where did we see Rav say that for Yuchasun you would always need two roves? That was what Rav said on the fourth line from the top of our daf, Avol Yuchasin Lo. In other words, that Im Rov Yisrael Yisrael, that is only as far as supporting the child, but as far as Yuchasin, no, one rove is not enough. So you see that Rav says for Yichus you need two roves, and Rav Chonan Bar Rav is telling us that the idea of two roves was only a Hiruas Shah, but for generations one rove is enough. Is there not a contradiction within Rav according to him? The Gemara answers, Man demasni ha, lo masni ha. And we look at Rashi. Lo masni ha, the Omer of Yudah Marav, the Kronos Shel Tzipori have a Maisa. The Mishnah that we turned into a two rove situation was by inserting that the incident in the Mishnah took place during the time of Kronos Shel Tzipori. But if you delete that information. In other words, you can tell me that for future generations you need to have two roves. The Mishnah was not with Kronos Tzipori. The Mishnah was a one rove, and Rav Chonan Bar Rava told us it was a Hiruas Shah. It was a momentary ruling, a one-time ruling. But for future generations, in fact, you would need to have two roves. So now we go back to the Gemara, having resolved matters for Rav Chiyo Bar Ashi and for Rav Chonan Bar Rava, each one in the way they presented Rav. So we should have no questions. Gufa. Now the Gemara goes back to analyze the source that was quoted at the top. Motzo ba tinok mushloch. Person found an abandoned child. Im rov ovdei kochavim ovdei kochavim. Im rov Yisrael, Yisrael. Mechza, mechza Yisrael. And you can see there's a sort of redundancy in this source, or it's something that's unnecessary, because you're telling me two cases which statistically are different, and in both cases he's viewed as a Yisrael. What is the difference between the classification of the child being Yisrael when it's Rov Yisrael versus the case of classification as a Yisrael when it's 50-50. Omar Rav, Lo Shonu Elo Lachyoso. The ruling in the source that if it's Rov Yisrael, that the community is majority Jewish, the child is considered Jewish, that's only with regard to the obligation of the Jewish community to support the child. Avol, Luyuchasin Lo, but for establishing a purity of lineage, that no. And as we saw before in the Rashi, we have to assume that the child was born from idol worshipping or Gentile parents. And therefore, in the case of a girl that would convert from that status, she would not be allowed to marry a Kohen. Ushmuel Omar, the Fakeach Olav Esagal. And now the Gemara will focus on Shitas Shmuel. On the side, under the Nosei heading, we have written Biur Shitas Shmuel, clarification, analysis of Shmuel's opinion, Binyan Heter, Chilul Shabbos, regarding the permission to violate Shabbos b'shul pikuach nefesh for saving a life b'matzav she'eno vada Yisrael, when it's not known as a definite Yisrael. E bo'inon lefachot rov Yisrael, in order to give license for the violation of Shabbos for this abandoned child, do you need to have at least the majority of Jews? Omuter afilu barov goyim, or is it allowed? Is one allowed to violate Shabbos even if it's a majority of idol-worshipping individuals? As far as the halacha is concerned, and as far as our presentation goes, one is allowed, one is required to violate Shabbos to save the life of a Jew. One is not allowed to violate Shabbos in order to save the life of someone who is an idol-worshipper. If that rubs anyone the wrong way, just realize that if you keep Shabbos, if you are a Shabbos observer, so part of the deal, so to speak, is that Shabbos will preserve you, meaning that if something life-threatening comes up, so you're allowed to violate the Shabbos. If you're not a Shabbos observer, so then you don't get the benefit of being allowed to have Shabbos violated in order to save that type of life. So that in our context, we're drawing the lines in a very clear fashion. For Jews, one is allowed to violate Shabbos for the preservation of the Jewish life. For an idol worshipper, though, one is not allowed to violate the Shabbos to preserve the life of an idol worshipper. Now the Gemara. Shmuel just said that if the majority of the people in the area are Jews, so the child would be classified as a Jew, this abandoned kid would be considered a Jew, and if there's any necessity of violating Shabbos to preserve his life, you can go ahead and do so. The Gemara asks, "Miyomar Shmuel Hachi? Does Shmuel say that you need to have the majority of the people there to be Jews in order to give license for Shabbos violation for preservation of the child?" Omar of Yosef, Omar Rav Yehuda, Omar Shmuel. We dash on Shmuel because we're focusing on his name. Ein hoychin bepikuach nefesh achar rov. Pikuach nefesh has to do with preservation of life. When it comes to matters of life preservation, we don't require a rove in order to allow whatever measures need to be taken to preserve the life. And as Rashi says, even if the majority of the community are idol worshippers, we will still violate Shabbos for this child whose identity we do not know, because we don't follow majorities in these kinds of cases. Elo ki itmar de Shmuel. Shmuel had made some mention about lefakech of Asagal, literally, that would mean to remove an avalanche of stones from upon a victim, which involves Chilul Shabbos. What did the Shmuel mean when he spoke? What was he talking about when he made reference to the extricating of the buried victim on Shabbos? Elo ki itmar de Shmuel areisha itmar. Shmuel's comment was with regard to the reisha of the source, the beginning of the source. It said at the beginning of the source, im rov v'kechovim o v'kechovim. If the majority of the locale were idol worshippers, the abandoned child is also viewed as an idol worshipper. Omar Shmuel ufakech olav esagal eino kein. But with regard to preserving him in a life-threatening situation involving the violation of Shabbos, we will not regard him as an idol worshipper. And as a result, even though the area is rove idol worshippers, the majority of our idol worshippers, we will still violate the Shabbos to preserve the life of this child, because we don't know him to be a definite idol worshipper. He might very well be Jewish. Above, we saw the following line. You can use the little star that we have, and you can see where we quoted it above. Imrov ovdei kechavim, oivei kechavim, lemai hilchus. When the source said that you found the abandoned child, if the majority of the people in that area were idol worshippers, the child is considered an idol worshipper. Well, with regard to what halacha? Certainly with regard to Shabbos violation, that's not the case. Omer Rav Papa, lachilo nevelos, to physically, proactively feed this child unkosher food. Nevelos represents unkosher food, unkosher meat. You would be allowed to proactively, to physically give a child unkosher meat, and he'll continue eating that. There are additional halachas that Rashi makes an allusion to because of classifying him as an idol worshipper. We continue in the Gemara. Im rov Yisrael, Yisrael. The source also made mention, if the majority of the people there are Yisrael, so the abandoned child will have the status of a Jew. Lamai hilchasa, regarding what area of halacha, Amar Rav Papa lahachsir lo aveda. If as this child gets older and he has possessions, and you found his lost item, you will return to him his lost item. We return lost items to Jews. We do not return lost items to idol worshippers. Number 3. Mechso al mechso Yisrael. Lamai hilchasa. If we say if the community is 50% Jewish, 50% idol worshippers, the abandoned child has the status of a Jew. Regarding what? Now, I'll tell you one thing regarding what it's not. Regarding restoring a lost item, under those circumstances, you wouldn't be obligated to do so. You're obligated to restore, to return a lost article, only if the majority of the community were Jews. So regarding what does this part of the source apply? Omer Reish Lakish Lenezikin. It has to do with laws of damage. And that's quite general and actually vague. So the Gemara says, hey, chidomi, well, what are the circumstances? Before we go into the Gemara, just a little word of introduction concerning tort law. If a person owns an animal, oftentimes we use the example of an ox, and an ox at times misbehaves, if you will, and will gore another creature. The goring ox. The goring ox, as far as the Torah is concerned, will pay only half damages for the first three times that it acts out of character and gores. That's called chatzi nezek. Tam mishalim chatzi nezek, using the terminology of the Gemara. This concept of paying chatzi nezek is only amongst Jews, that if a Jewish-owned ox gores another Jewish-owned creature, the owner will pay chatzi nezek, half damages. If you have the animal having gored more than a fourth time, he will have to pay full damages for the fourth goring. The idea of compensating someone for damages is true when the victim, when the damaged individual is Jewish. If the damaged individual is an idol worshipper, then he doesn't have that, he cannot lay claim to compensation. Now, let us see how to apply this into the Gemara. It was just taught by Reish Lakish that an abandoned child found in a community 50% Jews, 50% idol worshippers. The source told us he's considered a Jew. This has to do with laws concerning nezikin, damages. What hechidomi? What are the case? What's the case? He neimah the nagche tura di don l'tura di day. If one of our oxen, a Jewish-owned ox, gored this this unknown's, this abandoned child who grows up and becomes an ox owner, and the Jewish-owned ox gores this one's ox, why would the source tell me that I have to compensate him, this doubtful individual, that I have to compensate him as if he were a Jew? The source says he's considered a Jew. Why would I have to compensate him as if he's a Jew? Lay ma lay, let the offender, Jewish fellow, say, I see Raya d'Israelat, you, the victim, who is the Suffolk, you bring proof that you're a Jew, Ushkol, and then take from me, I will pay you compensation, and collect from me compensation. But until you can prove that, it's a matter of doubt. There's a 50% chance that you're not Jewish. And on those grounds, I don't have to pay you. I don't have to compensate you for damages. Loi tzricha. No, what the case is, the nagche tura di day l'tura di don. The unknown individual's ox gores a Jewish-owned ox. And now we say that this unknown, who is the offender, he has the din of Yisrael. Yisrael Hamazik, what happens when the Jew is the damager? We said, for the first three gorings, he pays only 50% damages, chatzi nezek. So, if the unknown is the offender, he has the right to claim Jewish identity and pay only half damages. Palga mishalem, half he pays. The idoch palga, the other half, Omar Luhu, the unknown says to the victim, the Jewish victim, you want me to pay you full damages, as would be the case of an idol worshipper who is a first-time offender? Well, I see Raya Delav Yisrael and Ovetain Lachon. You bring proof that I'm not Jewish, and I'll give you the other half. But until then, if you can't bring proof that I am not Jewish, I'm going to pay as a Jew. And it's with regard to that we said Mechsa Mechsi Yisrael, that if you find an abandoned child in a community where it's 50% idol worshippers, 50% Jewish, this child, and as he grows older, becomes the owner of oxen, claims himself as a Jew, which enables him to get away with paying only half damages when he is the offender. As you can see, the first perek of Ksubas ends at this point, and now we continue with the Mishnah at the beginning of the second perek. Ho'isha shenis armala, o'ishenis garsha. A woman who became a widow or was divorced. And when that happens, the woman lays claim to her Ksuba, the document guaranteeing a woman a certain level of financial security with specific amounts written in. And as we learn a sugya like this, we simply say that a woman who got married as a virgin has a claim of 200 zuz, a type of currency, and a non-virgin woman who got married would have a claim, like, let's say, a case of an almona. If a widow got married, she has a ksuba of 100. So our Mishnah describes a woman who is now laying claim to her ksuba. He omeres besula nasasani. She says, I was married as a virgin, and I'm entitled to the full amount. V'hu omer, and the husband says back, lo ki, elo almona nisatech. I married you as an almona. You had already been married to someone else before. Im yesh edim, Sheyotzis Behinuma Verosha Parok Subasum Asayim. If there are witnesses that can testify that on her wedding day she went out with a hinuma. We'll say for right now hinuma is a veil. And she went with her hair Rosha Parua, her hair was loose, falling down on her shoulders. That is a sign. These are signs of her having been a virgin. That's how virgins enter marriage. And therefore, Ksubasa Masayim. Rabbi Yochanan ben Broika Oimer, Af Chilu Klo Yisrael. Rabbi Yochanan ben Broika says that even the distribution of kloyos, of roasted grains, to children that attend the wedding, this is the practice at virgin weddings. They distribute kloyos to the kids. Umoide Rabbi Yeshua. This word umoide is going to be the focus of the Gemara. It means Rabbi Yeshua. Here he concedes, and we want to know why does the Mishnah present Rabbi Yeshua as conceding? What caused the Mishnah to point that out? But as far as the explanation of the Mishnah, Rabbi Yeshua concedes, "Be'omer l'chavero, sode zu shel avicha hoisa, ulekachtia heimenu." Mr. A approaches Mr. B. Mr. B knows nothing about the ownership of a particular field. Mr. A tells Mr. B, "You know, this field over here, this was your father's field, and I bought it from him." Shehu ne'emon. Here, Rabbi Yeshua concedes, the guy's believed. Why? And there's a very famous principle that we continue at the top of Daf Tez Zayin Amud Aleph. Shapesh osar hu hapesh shehitir. The speaker over here, he opened up with a phrase, with a comment, shosar, which is restrictive. He says to Mr. B, who knows nothing about the field, he says, "You know, this field was your father's." He's making matters bad for himself by saying that. If he would just keep quiet. So the speaker, Mr. A, could just continue enjoying the field without any worry on his mind. Here he volunteers information that is of a negative nature for his own cause. He says, "This field was once your father's." That would make Mr. B an apparent heir to the field. But Mr. A adds, "I bought it from your father." So Rabbi Yeshua concedes that Mr. A is believed. Shapesh osar hu apesh yitadi. The mouth that created limitation and restriction, it's the same mouth that creates permission and allowance. V'im yesh eidim shehi shel aviv. If, however, there were independent witnesses that could testify that the field belonged to Mr. B's father, and Mr. A says, "Yeah, all right, the witnesses say it's your father's, but I bought it from him," eino neman. There, he would not be believed simply by saying that I bought it from him. At this point, we've reached the end of our Daf Yomi quota. Mitzvah, next time we'll then pick up with the Gemara on this Mishnah.